This is Kim Sawyer conducting an oral history interview with Butch Morris in the Special Collections Library at Texas Tech on February 20th at 12:45 in the afternoon, year 2000. This interview is part of the Lubbock Area Vietnam Veterans Oral History Project. Mr. Morris, where were you born?
I was born in Snyder, Texas.
In Snyder, Texas. And where did you spend your early years in Snyder, or did you move around?
No, ma'am. We moved around. My dad was employed in the oil field. And we moved quite extensively, you know, until I was about in the seventh grade. And we moved to Monahans. Mm-hmm. And I lived in Monahans until I graduated high school there.
Mm-hmm. What was it like growing up in Monahans?
Oh, it was, you know, about like any small town. There was, you know, the drag that yeah. we had, you know, everybody went to. And I enjoyed it. And in high school, I was a member of the band. Okay. And I don't know about now, but I know back in those days, Monahans had a really good band.
Uh-huh. What instrument did you play?
I played the tuba.
Okay.
And, we got to march for the Cowboys way back when they played in the Cotton Bowl.
Oh.
And then, you know, took different trips and stuff. And it was, I had a pretty good childhood, I thought.
How about brothers and sisters?
Yes, I got two sisters and one brother, and they're all older than I am.
Okay.
I have a sister that lives in Slayton, one's in Arlington, and my brother lives in Austin. And my brother's a bit like that.
Oh,
too.
Yes.
He's about 15 years older than I am. And his experiences in Vietnam were somewhat different from mine.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say I had a pretty normal childhood as things go.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, when I graduated high school, the Vietnam War was going on, and of course it was on TV every night.
What year did you graduate?
In 68.
68. So you mentioned that in high school did you follow the war pretty
yes,
closely? I know, like you said, it was on TV.
Yes,
and before you graduated, had you decided to volunteer?
Well made up, yeah, I pretty well had my mind made up what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
It was I enlisted in the Marine Corps, and I had to go to Abilene to take my physical.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was going in on that 120-day delay program.
Okay.
Well, that's what I had told my parents, but I didn't have any intention of doing that. When I left and went to Abilene, I knew I was going in right then, but I thought it would be easier on them to think that I had a while to stay, and I thought, well, I might as well go, you know, get it started and
mm-hmm.
get it done.
Did you do this directly after graduation, or did you have any time
no,
in between?
No, it was about 6 months, I guess, later.
Okay. So can you talk a little bit about when you first told your parents that you were going to volunteer, how?
Oh, my mother was very unhappy. And my dad was a World War II vet.
Okay.
And my mother was totally against me volunteering. She knew that I wanted to go into the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
And, she had known, or she had other friends that some of their sons had been in the Marines
mm-hmm.
and had been in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And she even had some of those come and talk to me, try and talk me how to.
Did it have any effect on you?
No, I was going. You know, I had my mind made up. And, well, and it's funny, too. And ever since I'd been a little kid,
mm-hmm.
I'd always wanted to be a Marine.
Really?
You know, because you have this idea of the pretty uniforms, know, the honor mm-hmm. and everything that goes with it. And that's what I wanted to do.
Did you read a lot about the military growing up?
Yes, ma'am. I like history uh-huh. a lot. Mm-hmm. And that's where I had read about about the Marines and what they've done mm-hmm. in World War I okay. and World War II and Korea. Mm-hmm. And that was just part of it. Mm-hmm. That's what I wanted to do. And when I got to Abilene and had my physical and told them I wanted to go on in, made me feel bad because I called my dad and told him, well, I'm not coming home. Mm-hmm. And that was only the second time I'd ever known my dad to cry. Mm-hmm. he cried at his mom's funeral, and then he cried that night. And of course, all the things that you know go through your mind over a period of time. When I came home after I was discharged from the service, it was back in the days we didn't have the the quarters that go out to the planes that people walk through. It was back those days, it was walking down a set of steps.
Okay, sure.
And when I got off the plane at Odessa Midland down there, my dad was standing at the bottom. And it just dawned on me. It just came to my mind. He's the only one that really knew what I've been through.
Him being a...
He was in the Army too.
Did that influence you as well into joining the military? Was it a family tradition, a sense, would you say?
Yes, ma'am, I think so, because my brother was in the yeah. Army, my dad had been in the Army. Of course, I wanted to be a Marine, mm-hmm. you know. And it was just part of the, this is just something you're supposed to mm-hmm. do, you know. So that, you know, I guess that I really didn't have any, as far as I was concerned for myself, I didn't have any choice. Mm-hmm. It was something that was just supposed to be. Mm-hmm. Because if we're going to enjoy this country, you have to be prepared to defend it. And that's what I thought I was doing. You know, because I did, I believed in the domino theory. Mm-hmm. First Vietnam, what's next?
Mm-hmm.
Thailand, mm-hmm. you know, who knows? And I just felt like it had to be stopped. And that's what influenced me. Really.
Okay. Did you have many friends from high school that also volunteered?
I had one.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, he was already scheduled to go in,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't know it. And when I went to the bus station, he was there, and we went in together, and we were in boot camp together.
Do you recall his name?
Oh, Cotton Hayes.
Cotton Hayes.
And I don't know that Cotton was his right.
Okay.
But that's what everybody
yeah.
called him, you know. And we went through boot camp together, and I didn't see him after that,
mm-hmm.
you know, because he had a different MOS mm-hmm. than I did. And, I haven't had any contact with him or anything.
I wanted to back up just a minute. You mentioned that you followed the war with TV coverage.
Yes, ma'am.
And so you were in high school when Tet...
Yes.
And could you talk a little bit about that and what the general feelings were, maybe with you and your family watching the reports?
Well, my mother didn't watch it.
Okay.
My dad would.
Uh-huh.
And I would watch it. And the main thing that I was interested in the Tet Offensive of 68 was a combat base at Case Hall, because the Marines held that base, and that's what I wanted to be, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's why I kept track of Case Hall mm-hmm. pretty good, you know. And those guys didn't lose it, you know. And it's that, you know, that was part of the influencing factor when you joined the Marines, mm-hmm. you know. We took it and we held it, you know. And you can have it back when we get ready to give it back to you, but you're not taking it. And, of course, I realized, you know, a lot of people, it's funny that a lot of people think that the Marines are a little dumb, you know, because you don't know much except take that hill, you know. But it's, I think it's all in good humor with the mm-hmm. other service.
Okay.
But that's, yeah, I followed Case on really close. Well, in the atrocities that were happening in the Kuwait, mm-hmm. around Saigon and stuff, you know, and that's what I was talking about long ago as far as Bosnia. Somebody's got to stop that, you know, because those are innocent women, children, and men that are dying, and they don't have the capability at that point to defend themselves, so somebody's got to help them. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of, oh, I guess I would say the code of the West.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody needs help, you go help.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I didn't know at that time that some of the South Vietnamese units, they weren't really interested in helping themselves. They were, reluctant, I guess you would say, to fight a lot of times. And I know it got to the point, because we would take them out with us and teach them how to run patrols and run ambushes. And I finally told my platoon commander, I'm not going with them anymore. You know, it's because if you get hit, they break and run. You know, if you take them out on an ambush, they act like they're on a picnic. You know, they get out there and they blow up a rubber air mattress and take their boots off and open up cans of chow. And, no, I didn't need that, you know, because it was too much of a distraction. And they really didn't like it, that my platoon commander really didn't like it, but he accepted it and let me, you know. He let me, when I was a squad leader, that is, he let me run my squad the way I saw fit, and he didn't interfere.
Mm-hmm.
And when I told him that, then he didn't make me take him anymore. Mm-hmm. Which I was glad, you know, because if you're counting on somebody to help you, you look up and they're not there. It can give you a real sinking feeling, you know. But that was straightened out, I guess, probably in about June of 1970, or maybe just a little bit sooner, that I quit having anything to do with it. Because I don't have any respect for the South Vietnamese armies. I did for the North Vietnamese, because I knew what they wanted, and they knew what they were willing to go through to get it. Now, this great, you know, with atrocities and stuff like that, but I still had more respect for them than I had for the South Vietnamese. And, you know, I've heard people say that the Vietnamese people were stupid. No, they weren't. You know, they were, in a lot of ways, very ingenious. As far as what they could take, use against you. If you left it laying around, you're probably going to get it back.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I could back up just a minute, you went for your physical in Abilene.
Right.
And how long were you there before you... The next step was boot camp after Abilene? Or?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
We got to Abilene that afternoon, and they put us up in a hotel. And I guess the next morning, we had our physicals.
Okay.
And then that night, or late that evening, they put us on an airplane and flew us to Dallas.
Okay.
And then we flew from Dallas to San Diego.
Okay.
For boot camp.
Was this summer of 69? Is that?
No, ma'am. It was in January of 69.
Okay. January of 69.
When I left.
Okay. Could you talk about your experiences at boot camp?
Well, in ways, going to Vietnam was sort of like a tiptoe to the tulips compared to boot camp.
It was tough.
You know, in Vietnam, at least you could fight back. And when you were in boot camp, have you ever seen the show Full Metal Jacket?
Yes.
Okay, that drill instructor in there. That's pretty much the way it was. If there was anything that they did, they probably hit on us a little bit more than they did in the show. And looking back, the way they treated me in boot camp is probably one of the reasons I got home, because of the discipline, the self-discipline that they instilled in you. There was times in Nam, if I hadn't followed orders, I probably wouldn't be here today. But I know, like when they would give one of these orders, it never enters your mind, I'm not going to do that. I just did it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the reason I did it was because of the discipline I learned in boot camp. And that's why one of the reasons I made it back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because of that. And you know, the physical abuse in boot camp, the mental abuse in boot camp. Even with all what the Marines did, it still didn't prepare you to go to war. There's no, you just can't do that. I mean, you can crawl to an obstacle course with machine guns shooting overhead. C4 blowing up around you. But you know, if you stay low to the ground, that you never come through that. And it might get you used to the sound of combat. It does not get you used to combat. But they, you know, I think they did their best to prepare us for that. And I feel like, because of my training, that I was prepared to go as best as you can get.
Now, had any of your superiors in boot camp, had they had experience in Vietnam? Would they?
Yes, they would. We would have sessions at night. The platoon was about 80 guys, and they would have us together up at night, and they would talk about different things about Vietnam. And I know at one time they would show a TV show. Brought out TV and shows. Because in boot camp, boot camp back then, you didn't. There was no liberty. Even on base liberty. You didn't make any phone calls home. You didn't. What they call pony, you bait, like candy or gum.
Uh-huh.
You didn't have that. Okay. No movies.
What about letters?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you know.
Okay.
But you couldn't have packages for money, just letters.
Was that typical of all the branches of service or just the Marines? Do you know?
I think probably just the Marines. And I was there 10 weeks, and they said that boot camp was actually 8 weeks long. But they had 2 weeks of processing. Mm-hmm. We're doing that processing, we did everything that we normally did every day.
Okay.
So you couldn't tell when it was processing or when it was ready for boot camp.
Could you describe your typical day at boot camp?
Yes, ma'am. We get up about 10 minutes till 5. Mm-hmm. And by 5 o'clock, we had to have our racks made. Gear put away and be dressed and be out on what we call the platoon street, which was just the area in front of the clutch nuts. And the first thing we did is they'd march us down and we'd go to the bathroom as a group. And then they would march us to the chow hall and we'd have chow. And after chow, we'd go back to the bathroom. Or we call it the head.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then your day started out with you were either doing close order drill or some kind of physical training. Mm-hmm. And normally they got parts of both of me in every day.
Okay.
And then every now and then you would have classes, you would have instructors showing you how to take apart your weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we had some map reading classes in boot camp. And of course we had water survival training.
Mm-hmm.
That was a lot of times Marines are stationed on ships.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had to be, mm-hmm. You got to know how to swim.
Mm-hmm.
And, but we'd do those different kinds of things during the day. And then this would last till about, probably about 7:30 or 15 to late at night. And then we'd go as a group to take showers and shave.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we got back, we had free time starting about 8:30. And during free time, you had to write a letter home and tell them how wonderful it was and how well you were being treated. And whatever time you had from then, you had to polish your boots or polish your brass or clean your weapon.
Okay.
And then about 10 minutes till 9, we had hygiene inspection where we had to stand up on our foot locker. And they would walk by and look at our fingernails and our toenails and, you know, the bottom of our feet. And then about 9 o'clock it just lights out.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't normally mess with you after lights
okay.
out.
Was this Camp Pendleton?
It was in San Diego.
Okay.
Yeah, Marine Corps Recruit Depot.
Okay.
And then after I graduated boot camp, then we went to San Diego.
Okay.
And the first thing we went through was a infantry training regiment.
Okay.
There. And it was, as far as the discipline and all, it was quite a bit better because if I looked at us when we graduated boot camp, that we were Marines
okay.
now. And they treated you with a little more dignity
okay.
and more respect. And I think infantry training regiment lasted about 3 weeks. And we took extensive classes in map reading, weapons training and different kinds of weapons.
What were some of the weapons that you were trained to use?
When we used, taught how to fire the M60 machine. We had, of course, the M16 rifle, throw hand grenades, how to use claymore mines. And we fired the 3.5 bazooka, but we never used that in, because we had what we call a law, and it was like a bazooka, but it only had one round in it, and it was disposable. After you fired it, you broke it up. Mm-hmm. And the best thing to do was bury it. Mm-hmm. And then the M79 grenade launcher, we fired the 50 caliber machine gun, and the flamethrowers, we did flamethrowers. Of course, we saw demonstrations of different weapons being fired, you know, like a tank doing a firing exercise, mm-hmm. or they fired the 106 recoilless rifle, mm-hmm. you know. But that was about the extent of it as far as weapons go. Mm-hmm. And then you were taught pretty extensively in running patrols and running ambushes.
The strategy involved,
yes,
or okay, could you discuss that a little bit? What that entails, for instance?
Yes, ma'am. They would, like on patrols, of course, you'd have a map and a compass.
Okay.
And you would map out your. They would give you the patrol mm-hmm. out, and then you'd map it out on your map. And then we didn't do it in the States because we didn't have the radios. But, you know, you would go to, say, checkpoint Alpha, okay. checkpoint Bravo. Well, they knew where you were at when you told them that, mm-hmm. if you read your map,
okay.
you know, and used your compass correctly,
okay.
that you were at the right place, which is very important, because if you got hit and you needed air support or artillery support or you needed more guys to come mm-hmm. in and help you, I had to know where you were and how to get to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that, they stressed that a lot. And we went through three different things. We had, we went to the infantry training regiment, and then we went to the basic infantry training school, and then we had advanced combat training.
Okay.
And all three of those, you went to different places to do them.
Okay.
But yet you were still in the camp.
Oh, okay.
You
okay.
know. But all three of them stressed map reading.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, like I said, that was very important because you had to have the means to let them know where you were at. You know. And, of course, if you needed fire mission or air support, you sure want to make it right where he is mm-hmm. at. You know, you didn't want it dumped on you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why they stressed it so much.
Did anyone have trouble with that particular skill that you
yes,
recall
ma'am.
People did?
Yeah, because some guys, you know, they can't. You had to triangulate
yeah.
your position.
Yeah.
Well, you have to be able to pick out two landmarks
mm-hmm.
that you know are on that map and which ones they are, and then you shoot an azimuth to this one
mm-hmm.
and say shoot an azimuth to that one, and then when they crossed, that's where you were
mm-hmm.
and some guys, you know, had trouble, like if he was, say, 600 meters high as opposed to 300 meters
mm-hmm.
high, if they set the azimuth on the wrong hill, then it triangulates your position
mm-hmm.
of someplace you're not there. And they had trouble with that. And I was lucky, you know, because it just made sense
yeah.
to me what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that they had, and they also had in Vietnam, the maps that we had were, I mean, they were absolutely wonderful. You know, the most minute detail, that map would show it. Like if you were on patrol, and in some place during that patrol, you were supposed to cross this river, and right there where this river made a little S, well, if you'd shot your azimuth right, you crossed and you saw that little S in it, that river right there. And the, yeah, the, I was very satisfied with the map that we had. And of course, the compasses were good. So that was pretty easy. You know, now if you had to move at night, that was a different story, because you didn't have, you know. I mean, you can't. Where your landmarks, you can't see. And of course, it's dark out there. You know, it's not light. Because we never operated, well, except one time we operated close to the provincial capital of Quezon. And that was the only time that we got close to a big village, or maybe even a city. Maybe that was classified as a city. And we only did that one time, and that was right at the beginning of the Tet. And the rest of the time, we were out in the middle of nowhere. You know, there were, you might run across small villages with one or two, three, four people. But other than that, and like when you're going out on an ambush, you would go out and late in the evening, and just before dark, you tried to get to your ambush site. Just before dark, and you would stop short of it. Then when it got dark, you went ahead and moved over into your ambush site. But you were able to see where you were going, you know, to know that you were there. You know, and at night it's very critical that they know where you're at, you know, because you're probably not going to get much help on the ground if you get into trouble. It's probably going to come from either artillery or air support. So that was pretty important.
Any other things come to mind about your training or your advanced training?
I know a lot of it, there wasn't as far as doing physical exercise, as far as squat thrust, push-ups, and stuff like that. We didn't have an awful lot of that. We had an awful lot of walking. You know, and they called it at a route step, which is just about, if you're at the back of the column or close to the back of the column, you're in a dead run all the time, going up down the hills. Well, that puts you in a real good physical shape, you know. And actually, I was in better shape after I left, you know, the training schools than I was when I got out of boot camp. Because it was, first of all, you got to eat more. You know, because in boot camp, they would tell you, you didn't do anything unless it was by command. And I mean anything, you know. Well, you go through the chow line, and then you get to your table. Well, they'd tell you, set your tray down, then they'd tell you, sit down. And they'd tell you to bow your heads, and they'd say a prayer, and then they'd tell you to eat, and you had to get on with it, you know, because you didn't want to know when they were going to say, get up and get out, you know. Well, that tray had to be clean before it was left, and a lot of times, you were doing so much running and physical exercise and all that you didn't get enough to eat. Well, after we got to the training regiments and stuff at Camp Pendleton, first of all, we had a little more time to eat, and then we could go back for seconds and stuff, you know. And then like milk, you could drink as much milk as you wanted. So it was, you know, you got really good physical check. And you needed to be. But other than that, that was, I met some really good guys. Yeah, of course. I don't know what it is. When I got out, I didn't have any desire to be in contact with any of them. And now that I'm older, I do. But I don't want to do that. My best friend, Adam, was a Puerto Rican from Bronx, New York. And, he went home about 3 months before I did. And I was really glad because he was nothing but screw up. He got in trouble all the time. And he would make it up to squad leader and then do something. And I'd always go get him back my squad because I knew I'm going to take care of him. And as much as I love the guy, I was really glad to see him go home because I knew he'd be all right. And when I got back, his name was Jose Lopez. And when I got back, I was at the airport at Los Angeles, and I called the information for Bronx, New York. I was going to get a telephone number for him to call him. And she asked me if I had an address, and I said, no, it's Jose Lopez all I got. And she said, sir, you realize how many Jose Lopez's there are in Bronx, New York? And I said, no, man. She said, you can pages of them, you know. So I never had any contact with him since I got back. But I did. I really loved the guy. As a matter of fact, I probably loved Lopez more than I loved my brother. You know, we were that close. Because it was one of those deals that if one of us had something to eat, we both had something. One of us had water, we both had water. I don't know, you know, why I bonded with him so soon when I got over there. But I guess maybe it's because I was born and raised in Texas, you know, and I was used to being around Spanish people. And maybe that was it. I don't know.
Did you have any time off before you went to Vietnam after you completed your training, or did you go straight?
Yeah. No, I had about, well, I got through with my training. It seemed like it was about June. And I had volunteered to go to Vietnam, and they wouldn't let me because my brother was over there.
Is that standard policy?
I think so, you know. And I kept bugging them to let me go. That's what I joined the Marine Corps for. You know, I didn't join to stay here and play silly games. You know, like go out on maneuvers and all that. You know, that's not what I joined the Marine Corps for. Well, when they kept, it was funny. I left. They got back in the States about 2 o'clock that night. And I left at 11 o'clock that night. You know, he got back at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I left at 11 o'clock that night. Well,
what's your brother's name?
Billy Morris.
Billy Morris.
And it was a hassle for me to get to go. You know, because I didn't think they were going to let me go. And that's what I joined up for. I finally gave in, you know.
What did you do while you were waiting?
Oh, I was with what they call part of permanent personnel. I was with the 27th Marines for a while, and then they disbanded and went over to the 28th Marines. Of course, all this was in Camp Pendleton. And we did, we played silly games, we'd go out on the neighbors, you know, and almost stay awake. And of course you'd run patrols and ambushes and attack hills. And to make what was so silly about it is a lot of times we didn't have what they call a blank firing adapter for your weapon. And we didn't have any blank ammo either.
Okay.
So you had to go up that hill and go ahead, bang, 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 bang. And I thought, this is ridiculous. I've got to get out of here.
Were there a lot of people in your situation that had to were kind of an on hold before they could go? Or?
Well, a lot of the guys, well, probably when we went to the 28th Marines, about half the guys there had been to NOM, you know, and they were still in. And then about half of us hadn't been to NOM. Yeah, there were quite a few of us. Mm-hmm. Now there weren't a whole lot of us jumping up and down the gutter, you know. But like I say, that's a personal deal as far as I was there, because I knew when I joined.
Now these guys that had already been to Vietnam, what kind of conversation would you have with them about? Would they talk about their experiences at all?
Some, but not a lot.
Okay.
You know, the biggest thing that I noticed about those guys was their attitude towards the Corps. They were what we call short-timers, you know, and all of the discipline and everything that you learned, they weren't really into that anymore. You know, they were ready to go home, and it was hard to make them, like, we'd go on a 3-mile run. Well, we'd be strung out for 3 miles because they get tired of running and start walking. You know, and what are you going to do with the guy? I mean, he's getting ready to get out.
Yeah.
So they just didn't care. Okay. And I could understand that. Mm-hmm. You know. But now most of them would talk about their expenses or experiences. Okay. A little bit. Every now and then, you know, a little bit. It seemed like most of the conversations I had with them concerning Vietnam was like them giving you hints on map reading, ambushes, how to set them up, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know? They didn't go into personal details of what they had done.
Mm-hmm.
But most of them were pretty good guys. Mm-hmm. You know? They were just ready to get out. Sure. You know, and I don't blame them. If you weren't going to make the Corps a career, I would see no reason for staying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, because what do you got? Playing silly games.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And they weren't into it anymore.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And I don't blame them. Of course, I was lucky. I got back to the States on December the 1st, and I was out on December the 3rd on my way home. I was very satisfied with that at the time, you know, because I lied. Well, I got out the 3rd of December, and I actually should have got out the 27th of January. But you're real short, and they don't have, you know, they don't have anything to do.
Yeah.
You know, because if you go to a school, even if you finish the school, it's time to get out.
Mm-hmm.
So they were getting early out.
Okay.
You know? And then I heard, and I don't know this to be true, but I heard that the Corps was given up to 2.5 years at that time. Like if you'd went on a 4-year enlistment, they were given a 2.5-year cut because they had so many guys in the place to put them. You know? And one of the problems that the Marine Corps had then, and one that it has even to this day, they don't have the money that's available to the other services. And the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy would be just as happy not to have the Marine Corps because that would release that funding to them, what the Marine Corps doesn't have. because it, in Desert Storm, I don't know if you paid a lot of attention to it or not, but like the Army had the Apache helicopters. The Marines had the Cobra helicopters, the same helicopters that they used in Vietnam. And they called them the Super Cobra because they had added another engine, you know, and maybe changed the Army around a little bit. But it, well, I used to tell her, and I still do, you know, we were poor, the Marines were, and we just didn't have the resources to, you know, and they still don't. And I don't, I think it's better, but it's still not as good as it should be. And I think as long as there's that competition, you know, between the other services, it's going to be tough for the Marine Corps to survive. Because they're just tricky. You know, why do you need the Marines when the Army can do the same thing? You know? Because the Army can't do the same thing. And we've been criticized a lot for going out and getting our dead under fire. But it's just an unspoken rule. You do not leave anybody. If there's enough of him to bring back, you're gonna go get him. If you lose two or three in the attempt, that's just, you know, and I guess maybe a lot of people might think that's stupid, but it's, that's just the way the Corps is. If you go, you're coming back because you're one of us, and we will not leave you, you know. And this might sound strange, but I knew that if something happened to me in Vietnam, that I would still come home. And it was a certain amount of comfort to that for some reason. You know, I really can't take one, but it, you know, I knew I would be back in the United States. And that's one of the things I love about the Corps, because it hadn't changed from, well, 1775. You know, this is the way it is. That's the way it is today. And that won't change. There might be a lot of other things change, that will change. And I have no doubt about that. Because as long as there well, and this may sound sacrilegious, and it's really not, but, you know, the Corps is almost like a religion. Come bound to it, and you hardly see anybody that those bonds would break. You know, because they're saying once a Marine, always a Marine, and that's very true. You know, and what's funny about it, Jim, is like a lot of it, like you can meet a World War II veteran being a Vietnam veteran. Your wars may have been different, may have been fought differently, but there was a common denominator to it, and that was boot camp. You could always go back and talk about how you were treated in boot camp. You know, that didn't change. You know, they beat on those guys. You know, 50 years ago, they beat on us 30 years ago. You know, it just sucks. Now, today, I don't know. I've heard that they don't do that. Yeah. But that doesn't mean they don't do it.
Yeah. You know? They just don't tell everybody they do it. Could you tell me a little bit about your rifle training?
Yes, we in boot camp, we were in San Diego. And when it came time for rifle training, they took us to Camp Pendleton. And we were on firing range for 2 weeks, because one of the sayings of the Corps, and it's very true, is every Marine is a rifleman. You know, It doesn't matter whether you're a truck driver, mm-hmm. or a helicopter pilot, or a clerk. Mm-hmm. You're going to learn to shoot. Whatever, mm-hmm. you know, I guess it's still the M16. Mm-hmm. You're going to learn to shoot that, and you're going to become proficient with it. And everybody goes through the same thing as far as rifle training. And if you don't qualify, they're going to keep on you till you do.
Do you have to repeat the training, or you're there as long as it takes, or?
What it was called back then, they would drop you from the platoon. Okay. And you would have to catch up with the platoon that was behind you to go through rifle mm-hmm. training. But you were going to become proficient with the weapon, even though you might just say qualified marksman. Mm-hmm. You know, you were at least going to qualify that. You know, that's sort of like a set in stone rule of court. Mm-hmm. Every Marine is a rock. Okay. With the size of the Corps and what they're expected to do, I think it's a very good policy. You know? Mm-hmm. Because you don't ever know when you might need that desk clerk or that cook.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
To stand beside you in that foxhole, you know. And you need to know that he knows how to shoot. Because your life may depend on it. And I think that was one of the Corps' very good policies. And he's still that way tilted mm-hmm. about him.
Any problems with the M16 that you recall?
I know that in Vietnam, you had to keep it extremely clean. Mm-hmm. And you also had to keep your magazines clean. Mm-hmm. Because they were some kind of aluminum, and they would corrode some.
Okay.
Well, they would get with the spring, you know, wouldn't make the brand feed into the weapon. Well, you had to... You had to keep it clean, mm-hmm. or it could get you in trouble. Mm-hmm. If you did.
And these were problems you didn't have during your training, was it?
No, see, when we qualified with the M14 rifle.
Okay.
And the M14 is an excellent piece of equipment, mm-hmm. because the day we qualified, it was raining, and it was sort of like, I don't know if you'd call it chat or whatever it was that we laid up.
Mm-hmm.
But we were in the mud, mm-hmm. you know, in the promises. Mm-hmm. Well, that weapon got some of that in there. And it's still fired. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just the M14 is just an excellent weapon. The problem being with it in Nam, it was too heavy. For a lot of the terrain that we went uh-huh. through, you know.
How much does it weigh, do you know?
Loaded, I think, weighs about 10 and a half pounds.
What about the M16?
Oh, it probably weighs about, I can't remember, probably eight and a half, you know. And it's not as long, you know. And another advantage the M16 has is you've got a selector switch, or had a selector switch on those models, that you could go from safety to full automatic to semi-automatic.
Mm-hmm.
With an M14, you had to use an external piece on it to make it fully automatic. Yeah. Of course, the M14 shot the same size round as the M60 machine gun,
mm-hmm.
which the M60 is an excellent piece of equipment too. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, you have to keep it clean, but it's not as finicky as an M16.
How long was your infantry training? How long did that last?
Probably about 3 months.
3 months, okay.
And then I was with the, you know, the permanent personnel, 27th, 28th. And then when it got time for me to go to Nam, I got leave. I think I got 21 days leave. Okay. And when I came back, I went to what they call a staging battalion.
Okay.
Okay. In staging battalion, it was, I think it was about 3 weeks long.
Was that in the States? That was before?
Yes, but okay. That was still in Camp Cumber. You know. Oh, you had refresher courses on map reading and, you know, finding weapons and stuff like that. And then during staging battalion, they made sure that everybody had a wheel rope and that your insurance was in force and who was the beneficiary. One thing I disagreed with in staging battalion, everything that you had as far as what you had gotten in the States as far as your utilities and your combat boots and all that, like your combat boots, you were going to have what they call a jump on the bunking inspection,
mm-hmm.
where everything you got's laid out,
okay.
except what's in your wall locker.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all going to be hung in there in a certain order. You mm-hmm. know. Well, your dress shoes and your combat boots, the soles and heels had to be good. Well, I don't like mine. I had to take mine down and have them re-soled. And then when you got to know me, wore jungle boots. That's funny. It didn't make any sense. You know, it was a waste of money.
Uh-huh.
And the court didn't make any money off of it because you had it done in town.
Okay.
You know. Well, now there was a place on the base you could get it done, but most guys took it to
family.
You know, you get delivery on the weekend, we dropped them off
mm-hmm.
early in the morning, pick them up, you know, like that. But I thought it was ridiculous because combat boots just weren't cut out for it, too much work.
But you would take them with you?
Yeah, we took
them with you. You took them with you and then you... Okay.
We left most of that stuff in Oklahoma.
Okay.
And then we took some of it with us on the ground
mm-hmm.
in what we call the sea bag, something that's built back.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know how long we had it. You know, it's, when we came home, they had an excellent filing system because they went right to your stuff and got it for you. So it was all in there.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, who wanted it? You know, when I got home, the day I got out, I dropped it off at Goodwill. What everything except what I had on my back.
Right. Mm-hmm. Did you take a commercial flight charter to Vietnam?
Oh, I guess it was a chartered flight because it was on Continental Airlines.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. We flew from El Toro Marine Corps Air Base to Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we spent either 1 or 2 nights there in Camp Butler. And that's where we stored our stuff.
Okay.
You know, and then, well, it was Continental that we flew on into Vietnam. We landed at Da Nang Air Base.
Okay.
And coming home, I believe, it was a Continental plane. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, when we flew out and went to Okinawa, there was a problem getting a flight out for somewhere. I can't remember. Anyway, we were on Okinawa 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, they really didn't have anything for us to do. You know, so we get liberty about 9 o'clock
uh-huh.
in the morning. You know,
uh-huh.
and you had to be back in, I think, at 3 or something like that.
Did you explore the city a little bit, or did you stay on base?
No, I explored the city.
Uh-huh.
I guess I explored every bar. No. Because, you know, it was, well, even one over there in Nam, you had to be an A5 if you were in the Marines to buy a hard liquor.
Okay.
You know. But you also had to be 21. Well, I made it to the E5 spot, but I didn't make it to the 21 spot, you know. Well, then when you come back and you hit Okinawa, they don't care how old you are. You know? Well, it was just a, I guess it was just blowing off
yeah.
steam from 5 days.
At that point, were you and your fellow Marines anxious to be there or apprehensive?
Oh, we were, no, we were ready to go.
You were ready, okay.
Once that plane would get herself down. Okay. Because we really didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't think we knew until like the day before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when exactly we were leaving.
Mm-hmm.
But, it was a good, we had a good time in Okinawa. But, I'd rather have been sitting home at the breakfast table,
mm-hmm.
you know, talking to my mom and dad mm-hmm. than I had there.
Mm-hmm. So, were you 18 or 19 when you arrived in Vietnam?
I was 19.
19 years
old. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about your first impressions of Vietnam when you stepped off the plane? What do you...
Oh, the first thing that hit me when we got off, because it was real cloudy,
mm-hmm.
you know, when we were coming in. And then when we broke the clouds, visually the first thing that hit me was how pretty it was. Everything was so green.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it looked like it always laid out, you know, real neat.
Mm-hmm.
Like the rice paddies and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we landed at Da Nang and we got off, the first thing that hit you was the heat and the smell. You know, the smells. There was a big garbage dump around there someplace, but it stunk,
mm-hmm.
you know. But it didn't take you long to acclimate
okay.
to it. And I guess one thing that helped me is I arrived there during the monsoon season.
And what month was this?
Oh, the monsoon. It was in December.
In December, okay.
And, of course, it rained all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time it got to be summer, it would start getting some hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of, I was in there in cooler months, and it finally got you still got real hot, but by that time you sort of eased into
okay.
it,
mm-hmm.
you know, which helped.
Yeah.
But I know during the monsoon, you know, I hated the monsoon and the weather more than I did the BC or the NBA. And this is one thing that I never have understood, mm-hmm. you know, because even then, the United States was the most powerful and well-equipped military in the world. And it seemed like that I got to Vietnam on December 1st, I believe. I can't remember. Anyway, I know for sure it was the 12th of February before I got a punch in. With monsoon, you know, we worked out of a fire support base.
Mm-hmm.
And, normally, we would stay inside that fire support base for like 3 days at a time. We would get haircuts and their clothes
mm-hmm.
and boots and whatever. And then they'd update your shot record. You know, if you need some kind of booster shot
mm-hmm.
or something. And of course, you got hot food. And, you do stuff like get to go to the movie,
mm-hmm.
you know, and stuff. It's sort of like an R&R deal. And it would last about 3 days. And then when we'd go back out, and we would be back out about anywhere from maybe 4 to 6 weeks at a time. Well, I had a poncho liner, but I didn't have a poncho. And a poncho liner is nothing but like a little old thin quilt, you know. And that held out the water.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it made it so long after even a poncho would, but at least a poncho would keep your body heated.
Yeah.
You know? And I was telling you about Lopez, you know, how close we were. Well, he didn't have a poncho either. And if we were in place, it was suitable. We would try to hang a poncho liner over us, and then we would sleep under the other poncho.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I mean, you slept,
mm-hmm.
you know, right up against each other, mm-hmm. because your body, mm-hmm. you're trying to protect your body. And I can remember one time, it had come sun up, we were sitting on the side of this little old hill, and I had my poncho liner wrapped around me, and your whole skin was just white, you know, because you don't have to get your head slip for 2 hours or something. And I can remember praying, you know, God, just let me see the sun. You don't have to leave it out. Just let me see that it's still up there, you know. And then every now and then it would break off and get these big old white, billowy clouds mm-hmm. along, you know. You know that it was going to rain for 3 or 4 hours, and then it would cloud back mm-hmm. over. It wasn't. I don't even remember just a flat pouring down rain,
okay.
but it was just a steady rain.
Yeah.
You know, and then it'd sort of drop off to maybe a real light rain,
mm-hmm.
and then go back up to a steady. And it was just miserable because.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think in a climate like that, that you'd be warm,
mm-hmm.
but when you're soaking wet,
yeah.
you're cold.
Yeah.
You know, and, I hated that because you couldn't. Like, say, we didn't have any. Wherever you laid down, that was your house in your bed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved a lot. We might not move far, but we moved. We moved every day.
Mm-hmm.
And we got in the habit, or I guess they were already in the habit of it. When you moved, you would move back to a place that already had foxholes to go. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Because, and then you'd sit in there at night. No, we didn't dig foxes.
Mm-hmm.
It was lazy, is what it was. But you had to be careful
mm-hmm.
because they would booby trap the bottom of the foxhole and they'd shoot at you. Well, the first inclination is to jump in that foxhole.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you hadn't checked it out,
okay.
you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
The only good thing that I can remember about monsoon is a lot of their booby traps and their fragmentation grenades. They worked on what they call pool bricks and fuse.
Mm-hmm.
So like, they'd be attached to a string and then pull that string
uh-huh.
through. It was like striking a match.
Okay.
It's even soaking wet.
Yeah.
That's the only good thing I can see about monsoon.
Okay.
You know, is the booby traps.
Uh-huh.
And you got by a lot of times because of that. You know, because they'd throw one at you night or something, wouldn't hit me. And I know that one of the things, and I don't really know how the human body does it, but you go to sleep, but you're not really asleep. You're still aware
mm-hmm.
of what's going on around you. After a while, that you get really tired. And, because like I say, every day we moved.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of complicated.
Yeah, how long were you at Da Nang before you were actually assigned, until you knew exactly where you were going?
Oh, probably, I looked out there probably the next day.
The next day, okay. So they give you orders, or did you have an idea what you would be doing at that point? Or
well, they just told me that I was going to the
1st Battalion, 7th okay. Marines. And they were working at a fire support base, Ross, mm-hmm. at that time. Mm-hmm. And they trucked us out to this place called 11th Motors. Well, that's where the helicopters would come in that were taking you back to the fire support bases that you okay. were going to.
Okay.
Well, then you would wait at the fire support base, and when there was a resupply mission going, mm-hmm. you know, to your unit, you'd catch a ride on that resupply, and that's when you'd go to the field.
By helicopter, or was this by
yes,
transport?
Ma'am.
Okay.
Now, see, there was the majority of the time where we worked, I'm going to say probably 90% of the time where we worked, there were no roads.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I mean, you were out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
You know. So everything we got, we were dependent on helicopters mm-hmm. for. And so that's another thing about monsoon. If the helicopters can't get in, you don't get anything mm-hmm. to eat. And it didn't happen a lot. It might have happened 2 or 3 times, 4 times, maybe. But the most we ever went into tonight was 3 days with nothing to eat. And you can get really hungry in 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and then you'd be lucky and maybe run across a sugar cane field or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But, of course, sugar cane's not real filling. You know. But that's all you
mm-hmm.
have.
Mm-hmm.
And the first company commander I had when I got over there, his name was Lewis Anmore, and I won't forget him because he took better care of us than anybody I had the rest of the time that I was in Vietnam. Because his theory was, if you'll eat 4 meals a day, I'll order you 4 meals a day, sea rats.
Uh-huh.
You know. And in that stuff that I gave you, or, you know, to the archives, there's a, just right here.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Lieutenant Anbord. He didn't order these guys to do that. They went out on a killer team.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to try to justify what they did, because what they did was wrong. Well, it was murder. You know, even in a war zone, it can be murder. Well, they were so frustrated. Because what had happened to us, because we were taking all these casualties and we didn't have anything to show in return,
mm-hmm.
you know. And frustration is what caused that. Also donated a book called Blues Bastards, written by Randy Herod. Okay, Herod was the leader of the killer team that night.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I never did figure out how they got around it, but Herod was found not guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And since he was given the orders, I don't know if he had people under him found guilty. He had to be found guilty, mm-hmm. you know, but it didn't happen that way. Of course, he had lawyers come from the States to name the defendant. He also mm-hmm. had Oliver North. He'd been in Oliver North's platoon previously. Well, Oliver North was back over there. You know, trying to help him. But Herod says in his book that they took machine gun fire at that village. Well, they didn't. Because they hadn't been going probably 30 minutes
mm-hmm.
you know, when this happened. Well, to an AM board. The reason he got relieved of duty is when he found out the next morning what they had done, he had a rifle, a captured rifle, sent out from the rear to the field. Mm-hmm. So he could say, well, this is the weapon they took fire. You know, the serial number had already been registered at the Provost Marshal's office, and they caught him. So, well, he didn't tell them to go out and kill whatever you find.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do that. Lieutenant Edward was a good Marine. But he tried to take care of his men, and that's what got him in trouble.
You were actually there with us.
Yes, ma'am. I wasn't with those
with
five
the
guys.
People, but you were in.
I was in. Yeah, they were. I was in third platoon.
Okay.
And they were in third platoon.
Okay. Okay.
And a killer team, they would ask for volunteers. You know, does anybody want to go on a killer team?
And what did that entail? That one.
Well, what? See, if you went out on an ambush, you took your whole squad.
Okay.
And you, of course, you had a radio van, an M60 machine gun.
Mm-hmm.
You know. M79, man. Well, on a killer team, you either took four or five guys, and you didn't wear your helmets and flak jackets. You wore your soft cover or bush cover, normally, and you took that grease paint all over your face and all over your hands, you know. And instead of setting up a stationary ambush, you would go from village to village, going inside the hooches and stuff, trying to catch the VC, and a lot of times it was very fruitful, you know, to do that. Well, that's what these guys have done.
Okay.
And why they did what they did, I know why they did, they were frustrated, but then I don't know why they did, you know. But we were just tired. You know, you don't get with them so long before the frustration builds up. Well, it's like that. Did you ever see that show, The Burning Bed, with Farrah Fawcett?
Mm-hmm.
You know, her husband beat on her all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then she finally got a bullet. Yeah. That's what happened. It doesn't make it right, but that's what happened. I don't know, you know, the way I ran across it, I was watching, you know, back when they was having the Senate hearings on the Iran Contra.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Harry came on TV, and that video didn't show his name, you know, and he was talking about Oliver Norton. And I'm sitting there thinking, I know this guy, you know, but I can't place him. Well, then they put his name up there. As soon as they put his name up there, I knew exactly who he was. You know, of course, he put on all weight, you know, and all. His hair was grayer, or gray, parts of it. And then I went looking and found the book. And I read the book, and what he said in the book's not true. And I don't know why. I don't understand the need to lie. Because he was found not guilty. Well, say you in a military court or Supreme Court, he won't get double jeopardy. He can't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was not going to be tried again for that crime. So I don't know why he didn't tell the truth. You know, I have run it through my mind a million times trying to figure out. Why didn't you just go? Well, you know, because he said, like, North took a Jeep down there by himself and went through this village, you know. Do you have any idea how much the Viet Cong or the NBA would love to have, you know, a lieutenant and a Jeep? You know, you would have had to be flat crazy to go out there by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that area, you had to be crazy to go out there to start with, because every time you turn around, you get shot at, you know. And I don't know what he, if you ever get a chance to read the book, you know, but he said other things like,
if I remember, that's what got them, the guards giving him a change for the coach. Was, the only money we had over there was paper money, you know, military paper machine. Mm-hmm. Well, back in those days, a coke machine wouldn't take that. And he said, we didn't have any money. So I don't know why. I just don't understand a lot of the stuff he said. But I'd really like to find what looked at him. Because I'm sure that after this was done, he got a letter of reprimand his record, but well, his career was over. Right? And I'm sure that he got out shortly after that. But I'd like him to hear that. Because he was so good. We had walked into an ambush one day. They had us dead to rights. You know, we were covered up and went to an ambush, called in artillery to start with. Well, you know, I told you about the map reading and all that. That first round was exactly where we were. You know, and he just, I mean, everything he did was just. You couldn't ask for him, but he took care of us. Mm-hmm. You know, he knew what the score was as for calling an airstrike or something like that. Well, as a matter of fact, he called it, the artillery was so close that some of our guys were getting hit. You know, but it had to be there, you know, because that's where it's coming from. Because they try to get right up on you to try to keep you from calling in artillery airstrikes. You know, they called it right in on top of you. You know, just excellent. You know, I can't speak highly enough of the guy. And all he was guilty of here was trying to take care of these guys.
And you were at, your missions were kind of based out of fire support? Base Ross, is that in this area?
For about the first 3 months. Okay.
Could you describe that base?
Oh, it was a battalion size and fire support base.
Okay.
And they had they had an artillery battery there, 105s, and 103-106s, and they had 81 millimeter mortars. Of course, they had, you know, the motor transport, and they had a chow hall there. And it was small.
Okay.
You know, because it was only a battalion size base.
Would you say it was well protected? Secure?
Oh, it was. I think probably as good as anybody could have been. But so we got it. For some reason, we weren't even scheduled to go in. And they just popped up one day and said we were going in. And we went in about 3 o'clock that afternoon. Of course, say our clothes, we stayed out so long, they just burned our clothes. You know,
after every time you come back in?
Okay. Yeah, because, you know, you had them on 24 hours a day for maybe 4, 5, 6 weeks, you know. Well, they just burned them and gave them.
What about boots?
It just depends on your boots. You know, of course, the boots were. They were sort of like a badge of honor. The worse your boots looked, that meant that you'd been out that long. And it sort of made you, always use the term salty, you know. If your boots were salty, it sort of commanded more respect, you know. Because everybody knew you wasn't a new guy, you know. Of course, then there were women's times. They just wore out, you know. You had to get them.
How were the jungle boots different from the regular combat boots that you trained with?
Well, on the bottom of them, the combat boots were fairly slick, mm-hmm. you know. And the jungle boots were, oh, I don't know how you'd say it. They had, the bottom of them, the way it was, they were built, I guess maybe in a way you could say they had sort of like treads on the truck tire, you know.
Yeah.
And then the top of them were canvas, okay. you know, to be cooler, yeah. you know, and lighter than combat boots. And then in the bottom of them, in the sole, it was a steel plate. Mm-hmm. And that plate was put in there. So in case you stepped in a punchy pit, mm-hmm. it would not penetrate mm-hmm. you know, into your foot. Mm-hmm. Of course, the Vietnamese got smart to it. And instead of just having, you know what a punchy stick is?
Yes. Yes. Okay.
You know, instead of having the punchy sticks just sticking right straight up,
uh-huh.
it'd have sticking right straight up. But then that also had to come in from the side to get you up here, so mm-hmm. there was no protection. And as a matter of fact, I just had a friend died. Well, his funeral was last Saturday. He had stepped in a punchy pit. And of course, they dip those things, you know, the sharpening and hardening. And then they dip them in whatever's convenient, mm-hmm. you know, to try to set up kind of infection.
Yeah.
Well, Gordon, whatever kind of infection he got, if I understand it correctly, is that it went to the weakest part of the body, which is the optic nerve. If I,
yeah.
You know, I don't know how to tell you this. True. This is what I understand. Mm-hmm. Well, he'd been blind for the last 32 years because of that. And they had tried like just mega doses of antibiotics, mm-hmm. like as many as 8 different kinds a day, trying to stop the infection. Mm-hmm.
So what's his last name?
Booth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was just very shattered. He had a peaceful world. And, I had a lot of respect for Gordon because even though he's blind, I never heard him complain. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that takes a pretty big guy to believe. But that's what they do with the bungee pits mm-hmm. to get around still.
Yeah. What about other booby traps? I know you mentioned the booby trap foxholes. Was there anything else you came in contact with or heard about?
Yeah, they would do stuff like, and normally it was one of our hand grenades.
Mm-hmm.
Like they would take a stick and drive it around and then take that hand grenade and attach it to that stick either with string or wire or whatever they had mm-hmm. available to them. And then, are you familiar with how hand grenades are made?
I've seen pictures of them.
You know, it's got this little arm sticking
yeah.
out. Okay, that's called a spoon.
Okay.
Right? It's got a pin through it.
Yeah.
And when you pull that, when you pull the pin mm-hmm. out, of course, you still got that spoon mm-hmm. locked in your hand. But when you throw it, that pin flies off. And it's got a deal that comes over and slaps, mm-hmm. and it starts a powder train burning. Right? When that powder train detonates, then it detonates a grenade.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what they would do is they would come across a trail with a wire, real small wire, and they would have this hand grenade fixed to whatever, a tree or stick, whatever, and then have the wire tied in the pin, and the pin is barely holding the spoon bit, and then they'd run that wire across the trail and tie it on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as you walk through there and you hit it, well, it didn't take much for that spoon, that mm-hmm. pin to come up and hit that back. And then one that that did the most damage that I saw at Kim. It's one of those that I can't remember the date of, you know. I know it was in June.
Mm-hmm.
But while I can't remember the date, I can't tell you how long it was, you know. But we set into a place
mm-hmm.
that we had set in before. Because of the size hole that it blew, we figured it was probably about a 500 pound bomb. That's what it was. And part of it, I don't know whether you'd say I ought to have myself kicked or. But anyway, when we were moving into this grove of trees
mm-hmm.
where we were going to set up, there were three old women walked out of there. Well, I was a squad leader by that time. And we worked in what was called the free fire zone, where anything that moved at night was fair game, you know. Mm-hmm. And three or four other guys. After we put our gear down, we went to this little village, just real close there,
mm-hmm.
to get water out of their well. And we were getting water, and none of those women were around. And I can remember thinking, that's odd. Because they know. Because it was getting late in
mm-hmm.
the day, you know. They know when the sun goes down, if they're not in their hutch, they're in trouble if they run across an ambush.
Uh-huh.
You know. And I mean, it registered on me, but then I didn't do anything about it. Well, we got our water and we went back in. Sit down. There was a kid in my squad. His last name was Cochran. Anyway, I told Cochran, I said, check that hole out. Make sure there's no booby traps in it. Yeah. And it was I just wasn't thinking. I had some kind of magazine that I was reading an article. Of course, they wouldn't have any light at night. Well, I was facing west, and I still had my helmet flak jacket on, and I had my legs crossed, and I was trying to read this book, you know. Well, the sun detonated. Well, it knocked me probably as far as compared to that stands. And the first thing that went through my mind was Cochran was dead. Because he, while he was trying to find a booby trap, he tripped it. You know. Well, then I rolled over. And all this stuff just kept following and following and following. And it went through my mind that I was dead. Well, it quit, you know, in the first, I mean, quit falling, you know, dirt, whatever. And the thing that, when it quit, the first thing you did was you try to get your people lined up because they would do stuff like that to you and then hit you.
Okay.
When you were confused and all that, you know. Well, I heard a guy on the other side of it, we call it in platoon position, which we call it the pause,
mm-hmm.
you know, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
A guy hollered and said, get cornered over here, I got a dead guy over here. Well, so say the Corman had been one of the ones that went with my dad to get blood. And it was in proximity to where he was. I don't know whether he set it off, or maybe they were laying around out there someplace and did what they call command dead man. I don't know. Maybe I did. But the thing that's nearly ate me up for years, he had only been in country like 7 days. I knew something was wrong when we went to get water. But I was too interested in reading that magazine to go there and take the new guy and say, let me show you how to do this. But I don't know where they dead named it or it was commanded. Mm-hmm. He was the only one that was killed out of the deal. But it medevaced like 17 guys. And a lot of them, it was just...
From that particular incident, 17?
Yeah. It blew a hole in the ground about as big as these two rooms. And probably 8 or 10 feet deeper. And one of the things that I think, you know, after analyzing all of it, I think probably what they had done is they had buried it too deep. Because if they had buried it too deep, they'd probably killed all of us. And it wounded the company commander. Of course, it killed the corpsman. The radio man wounded him. I mean, like, rifles, M60 rifles, they were melted together. Well, all we were left with was the platoon sergeant. And I wanted to forget that. Because I never did. You know, I never did do anything that I thought was just... I never did anything that I thought deserved a medal. You know, I mean, I just did my job. And this guy would not get up from where he was sitting. And me and this other squad leader called in the medevac. We got our hose set back in, because we had about 34 or 35 guys in the platoon. Mm-hmm. So it medevac half of it. Mm-hmm. And you had to set your hose in, back in the best you could. Make sure everyone was covered with what you had left.
Okay.
But he never got up. The medevac chopper came in and we got the corn out and all those other guys. That guy got a bronze star for that. And he was so scared he wouldn't even get up. And I don't blame him for being scared. I was scared too. You know? But it was his place to see if that was taken care of. And one thing that they did after that is they took him out of the field. And I don't know whether they thought that maybe one of us was going to do something to him. You know? Or what? But you just don't sit there. You know, if he'd have been just a rifleman in one of the squads, I understand that. He was not in that position. He was not, I'm the leader now. All the other ranks know I got to take hold here. I can't. Normally, some of the things in the novel are so burned into my mind that I want to forget them. the date, and why I can't get the date, or why I had forgotten. I don't know. But that's one of the things that, you know, of course, I don't know if you want this in your history there, but that's one of the biggest regrets that I've had. And I've carried a lot of guilt for that because I didn't go shit on that guy. You know, and he was too new to know. I don't know what his name was. Because everybody, every time we got a foreman, you know, the Marine Corps doesn't have their own medics. They come from the Navy. So he was in the Navy. But you look at him. Well, are you familiar with the flag raising on Mount Shirabachi in World War II? Or,
it sounds familiar, but.
Yeah, for
the
big flag raising.
Yes, yes.
See, that first guy that's been over there, that's got a hold of that flag pole, that's a Navy corpsman. So you looked at your corpsman like as another Marine, you know, and you took care of him. Except, I just drove around and
you were talking about Fire Support Base Ross and an incident that happened.
We got a hit there that night.
We caught 4VC the next morning at a bunker. But we started taking incoming mortar fire at about 1:30 that morning. And of course, the first thing you do, you know, is you run out and you try to get to the perimeter, to the bunker on the perimeter. And I don't know who counted them. Somebody said we took about 200 incoming mortar rounds. Like I said, I don't know who took the time to count them. I didn't, you know. But as soon as we run out of the hooch that we stayed in, it didn't have a rack on it or anything, or bed. We just slept on the floor. It was empty. We just slept on the floor. You know, and after you've been sleeping in the mud, sleeping on the floor is not bad. You know, because you're dry. You know, you got a roof on your head. But as soon as we came out of the hooches, they were already inside the fire support place. And they started shooting at us. And it was a mess. Because they were everywhere. And, you know, the mortar rounds falling. And we had heard that they had breached the line. Bunker 14, and I don't know who did it, but I guess it was an artillery officer or something. Anyway, he called our own 81 millimeter mortars in on top of Bunker 14. Well, I mean, common sense will tell you that if they're coming through that right there, that those four Marines that were in that bunker were already dead. You know? And I think the decision the guy made was the right one. But I've often wondered about how many nightmares he's had because of what he did. And him knowing, he knew that they were dead. You know, he knew that he didn't cost them their lives. And I know without a doubt it's about driving them crazy. You know, the because he's probably never convinced himself that they were really dead. Mm-hmm. You know. But anyway, we finally stopped them, you know.
How many were there?
Mm-hmm. From the four that we caught, we heard that there's a total of 50 inside the base. And they had been in there since 10:30 that night.
Okay.
They had gotten through the wire, uh-huh. You know, and were in there. And you think, well, how can that be? You know, you got lights on mm-hmm. the perimeter. And one of the sayings that we had was that they were so good that they could crawl up and steal your radio and leave the music, you know? So, and I went to Landmine Warfare and Demolition School in Denain,
mm-hmm.
and they showed us a sapper that had come over to our side,
mm-hmm.
and it was in broad daylight, and we were sitting there looking through all this barbed wire, and that guy came through about 75 yards of it in about 45 minutes. In daylight with us watching, and he was still hard to see. You know? So it's, I don't know if it, see, I want to say, and it doesn't say here, I'm going to say that we kill like 34 of them,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
but I don't, you know, that's one of the things I don't know for sure.
Were you ever wounded?
Yes, ma'am. I was, well, it wasn't too long after I got over there. I was walking point,
mm-hmm.
and I tripped a booby trap. And I got hit. But it was, you know, to me, it wasn't, I didn't even get mad about it.
Okay.
You know, and my squad leader was walking right behind me teaching me to walk the point, and he got mad about it. Because if he hadn't had his flak jacket on, he'd kill me.
Did you always wear your flak jacket when you were on patrol?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's what we went on in Florida.
Okay.
My helmet, my flag jacket were my two best friends.
Okay.
You know.
Did any guys you're with choose not to wear it? For instance, if it was too hot or heavy?
No. Well, it was just a standing okay. order. You're going to
okay.
wear your flag jacket and your helmet.
Okay.
You know. And if this guy hadn't had his flag jacket mm-hmm. on, at the very least, it would have paralyzed him. Probably killed him because it shrapnel had went through it and it was right up the middle where his spine
mm-hmm.
was.
Mm-hmm.
But it saved his life. Even well, to me, it would have paralyzed him and killed him. You know? But it blew me off the trail, you know. And I didn't know it until the thing come down some and a guy come by and said, "You're bleeding." You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think anything else about it until about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. I went to the VA because my hip was starting to hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, it's probably time for me to start having arthritis, you know. But, and they took x-rays. And the doctor told me, said, "Well, you don't have any arthritis." And I thought, well, why is my elbow hurting? You know? And she said, "You had 3 metallic densities in your arm." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "You had shrapnel in your arm." And I never knew that.
And that never bothered you before?
And she said, "What it done, when it went in, it was hot,
uh-huh.
you know, and it sort of seared it over."
Mm-hmm.
And there was calcium deposits
mm-hmm.
had formed around it, you know. So, and I didn't know, you know. And it's one of those deals that, you know, you get irritated with Vietnam because it won't leave you alone. You know, here after all these years, you find out something new. But there's no, I mean, it's not, it doesn't hurt you more. Mm-hmm. You know? My squad leader got the bulk of that deal. Because I think it broke his arm, broke his right arm. And he had a piece of the bottom of the foot.
He said he was training you to walk point?
Yes, ma'am.
Could you explain what that means?
A walking point is like when you go out on patrol mm-hmm. and ambush, you're the first guy that mm-hmm. goes. And it's your responsibility to find a way to get to the place you want okay. to go to.
How far would you be ahead of people? Or?
Oh, in normal distance, maybe like 15 meters. Okay. You know, yeah. not a whole lot,
okay.
maybe 10 meters. And I liked it. And I don't know what it was about it. But I guess I walked the point about 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of guys, like, it's a volunteer day. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have somebody to volunteer, you're going to walk the point okay. today. Mm-hmm. You know? But I liked it. And most guys would walk for like a couple of weeks mm-hmm. or so. But I don't know what it was I liked about it. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, I just don't know. But, you know, a good point man, like booby traps and stuff like that, so I was just learning then mm-hmm. when I hit that booby trap. And that was the lieutenant's fault. I thought what happened, we were called out, the platoon was called out, we were out of the field, and another company had some on the run from them. Well, we went out and to set up a blocking force, you know, and they're going to run into mm-hmm. us. Well, I don't know where they went, they never showed up, you know, but on the way down that trail, I can't remember if it was one or two, again, older women, sitting up on the side of this little barn, you know. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you say, well, I mean, there's nothing to do about it, you know. When we went down there and set up the blocking force, nothing came of it. So the lieutenant told us to, you know, let's go. So I asked him, you know, if he was going to give me a direction of travel. You know, mm-hmm. He said, go back the way you came from. And I said, no, that's not, I know better than that. You know, we were taught, if you go down that trail, mm-hmm. you have to turn around and come back up that trail. And the squad leader told me to, said the lieutenant was mad. And he said, I don't care. Go back that way. Well, we went back that way. Sure enough, they'd set a booby trap on the trail. You know? And but that's where you end up doing.
Could you describe the terrain that you would?
A lot of it. Well, when we worked in the Quezon Mountains. Of course, it was. We ran into more jungle mm-hmm. there, and some of it was really thick. Because mm-hmm. I had been in places where it was broad daylight, but you didn't see mm-hmm. because you were in that jungle. Mm-hmm. You know, and you had to be really careful. I didn't like that at all because you were. Completely disadvantaged, mm-hmm. you know, because a bunch of Marines going through probably a place sound like a bunch of water buffaloes going through, you know, just mm-hmm. crashing, and, mm-hmm. you know, all the noise that you know. But then the rest of it, most of it was fairly quiet, you know, and it was a lot of rice paddies, mm-hmm. Most of them cultivated. Then we worked in one area that was, I don't even know the name of the valley, on the other side of the mountains it was Antenna Valley, and on this side I don't know, but it looked like portions of West Texas, you know. It was pretty flat and had the vegetation that looks sort of like.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you receive different orders every day when you would go out on the missions where you'd be gone for several weeks? Or would you just get a general, like, cover this area in this amount of time, or how would that work?
Yeah, so we would normally, we had three platoons to a company.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We hardly ever worked together as a whole company. We did during TET, when TET started, because it was so bad,
mm-hmm.
you know, because of safety and numbers,
mm-hmm.
you know. But we would go out and we would be told to work an area,
mm-hmm.
and the way we work things is, let's say it's the first night that we'll go out, and we'll set up that night as mm-hmm. a platoon. Okay, you get up in the morning, and the lieutenant will have a place that he wants to go, the platoon commander, and you can say, okay, we're going over here.
Mm-hmm.
All right. When you get over there, maybe a mile, mile and a half, 2 miles away, you set up again. Okay. Then they send out two patrols and leave one patrol or one squad in the platoon position. Okay. You send out two patrols, two different squads. When those squads come back in, get up and move again,
mm-hmm.
you know, a mile, 2 miles, whatever. And you set up again, and when you set up again, one squad stays in, and it was normally the squad that stayed in that day,
mm-hmm.
and the other two squads go on ambushes, and the day that you stayed in, that was your day off.
Could you relax at all?
No.
I don't think so.
But then the next morning when your ambushes came in, mm-hmm. then you moved in. And it started all over, mm-hmm. you know. They wanted to just work all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
And a patrol, of course we call them clicks or 1,000 meters, you know, but a patrol that you would take out normally was anywhere from 4 to 6 meters long,
mm-hmm.
you know, clicks.
Okay.
You know, the lieutenant would give you the grid coordinates.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what I want you to cover.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and if you would take and go, let's say this is a map, here mm-hmm. you are. You go here, then you come over here and go over there, and then come back in.
Okay.
You know, you would always wind back up from where you started. Okay. You know.
How often would you encounter enemy troops or soldiers? Was it?
Oh, during TET, we probably did every day. And then you would hit times. And I remember this most after June, that you might send one or two of them
mm-hmm.
and take sniper fire.
Mm-hmm.
Or you might, you know, somebody might trip a booby trap or something.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as really getting into it with them, it might be 2 or 3 weeks. And then it might be 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'd be 2 weeks again before you got into it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just real sporadic. And it was funny, when we worked north, the Fire Support Base Baldy, which is also UO-51.
Okay.
If you were on the west side of Highway 1, which is a paved highway, and the reason I paved it was to stop people setting booby traps in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they dig through the asphalt, it shows
mm-hmm.
somebody's dug a hole. But it was funny. If we were on the east side of Highway 1, we ran into a lot more personal contact with them, you know, as far as ambushes and stuff like that. But if we worked over on the west, no, I'm sorry, the east side. The west side's where we run into contact with them. If we worked on the east side of Highway 1, what we normally hit was booby traps. And it never did make any sense to me. You know, what does that highway have to do with it? You know, I don't know.
Did you always know, for instance, if it was VC or NVA, or could you tell?
One of the biggest factors that you could tell is, like, if it was VC, you know, just the regular old farmer by day, VC at night, and they would take, and those AK-47s carried a 30-round clip, you know. Right? A lot of times they would shoot all 30 rounds at you, and that's it. Then they were gone. Right? If it was NBA, normally they would stay and fight you. You know, the NBA were tough. You know, and of course I disagreed with a lot of things they did as far as the torture and stuff. But I mean, they were worthy opponents. You know, they were good at what they did. They knew, the NVA knew, when we got into it with them, what we had at our disposal as far as we either had artillery support or air support or both, you know, it'd still stay and fight you, you know, knowing what was on the way. And, you know, that takes a lot of courage. They were good at what they did. No doubt about that.
You mentioned that you were a squad leader. Could you, what did that entail? What were your duties being a squad leader?
You would work to, like the platoon commander would call you up and say, I want you to take out a patrol and here's your grid for us. Well, then you'd go back and get what your point is. And if your point man was good enough, you could give him the coordinates, and he could shoot his own azimuths, you know, and draw his own patrol route. If he wasn't, you would help him do it, you know. But then, like at night, if you have an ambush, you would take, you know, your squad out. And you would, we call them holes. There would be a hole there, but that's what we call it. You know, let's say that you set up on the main trail and you were going to run what's called a Wagner shaped ambush. You know, it's like you're going from this way to this way, and here you are. You know, and you figure out how far you want to set up from it. You know, we want to put your claymores out. And then how many guys you're going to put each hole in, which ones you're going to put in those holes. You know. And of course, you ordered resupply for your squad, and if any of them had, you know, so they needed new boots and stuff like that, would you pass that on that I need a pair of size 10 boots, you know, I need 3 t-shirts and 10 pair of socks and so much footwear. You know, whatever. I didn't like being squad.
You didn't?
Because you're responsible for those guys' lives. You can make a mistake and it can be very unforgiving. You know? And I like walking point five, I like being squad. You know? And I was squad leader probably 4 months or so, you know, 4 or 5, I don't know.
How would you be resupplied with they drop, or would they land in a...
No, they, the helicopter, we had those CH-46 C-9 helicopters, and they would come in, and they would have a sling under them, and your resupply would be in there, and they'd come and set it on the ground, and get low enough where you could unhook the sling, and then they'd land, and you take all the stuff out of the sling, put the sling in the helicopter, and that's on low weather airways, because we had working in the air where there's any roads, you know, and we couldn't get resupply by air, we didn't get resupply, but that would bring in the mail.
So would you get mail regularly when you're out in the field, or?
Every time you got resupply, you got mail. Well, you know, probably 98 times out of 100 you get mail.
Did you write a lot of letters back home?
Oh, it would go in spurts. You know, sometimes you'd write for Rick and then you'd get on the kid.
Yeah.
You know, you know, there's only so many times that you can say the weather's pretty and the food's good. You know. But, I know I got medevac one time for 2 weeks. I was in the hospital with malaria. And then when I was in the hospital, I wrote a mile letter. I'd probably write 3 or 4 a day. You know, like to my mom and my sisters. You know. And
did you take any anti-malarial drugs or anything?
Yeah, they had them. What was it? Was it Sunday? Like it was Sunday, the corpsman had come around and get everybody a pill.
Once a week?
Seemed like the name of it was Primacum, Chloricum or something like that. But I, you know.
It didn't work for you, huh?
Well, and what's funny, it didn't work for the corpsman either. Because they had medevaced me. It was sort of funny, because I'd been sick like 2 or 3 days. And I kept thinking, will it go away? And we were out on patrol one day. And I came back in. And I went, after we got back in, I went up to my corpsman that was with us. And I told him, I said, boy, Doc, I feel funny. You know, they took my temperature and I had 103.8. He gave me 4 aspirin and he said, go take these and lay down in the shade and we'll see. And I thought, now if I've got 103.8, there's something wrong with me. So I wanted to lay down in the shade, but I buried those aspirins in the ground. Well, he came over in about 20 minutes and took my temperature and went up to 104. Well, that was classified as an emergency medevac. Well, they sent out 2 CH-46 C-9s and 2 covered gun shields. And what they would do, those CH-46s would stay up there fairly high, and those covers would come down and fly around trying to draw fire. Well, if they didn't draw any fire, then one of the C-9s would come down and pick you up. And the other one was up there just standby in case something happened. Well, when they picked me up, they took me to the LZ Baldy and told me to get off. Well, I got off. And say LZ Baldy was a fire support base. Baldy was a regimental fire support base. It's pretty big. Well, they sat down at the regimental aid station and told me to get off. Well, I got off. And here come 2 guys running out, and they had me set down, and they started an IV and told me to get back on the helicopter. Well, then the helicopter took me to the 9th, to the 1st Medical Battalion Hospital. And, I think I was there about 2 weeks.
So they were just stabilizing you, so to speak?
Yeah, trying to get my temperature down.
Okay, and then they moved you.
And then the time I hit the 9th, it was locked down to 102 or something. But they'd started the IV, and of course that... In that helicopter, there were holes in it, but there was no glass. You know, it had windows. Well, that when you get up about 5,000 feet, of course, it cools off considerably. Mm-hmm. Well, I had that cool wind blowing on me, plus I had
yeah.
temperature down.
How long did that affect you? How long were you in the hospital?
About 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
And I said my fever broke after like 2 days mm-hmm. or something like that, and I didn't feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like a 14-day treatment mm-hmm. for the whatever medication.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember.
So were mosquitoes a big problem? Insects when you were out here?
Oh yeah. And you had insect repellent, we call it bug juice, you know, that in liquid form you mm-hmm. pour it in your hand and
mm-hmm.
rub it on your face and stuff like that.
Did it help at all?
Some.
Mm-hmm.
And I know one guy, he had somebody rub it on his back, you know, and then he put his shirt back
mm-hmm.
on. And I think he covered up with a poncho that night. But the next morning when he got up, his whole back nearly was just covered in solid blisters, big old water blisters. He hadn't been that bad because of it. And it was something, I guess, with the heat.
Some reaction, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he was miserable.
Mm-hmm. What were some other illnesses that people were subject to out in the field?
Oh, we had a lot of dysentery,
yeah.
you know, and
any skin problems?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I had what we call jungle rot.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the right name for it, but I told him to medevac me. It finally got out of time. It started right along in here. And the corpsman that we had, he told me every chance I got, you know, to bathe and don't mm-hmm. wear my shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we didn't have anything to bathe in except rice paddies and mom craters. Well, it kept getting worse. And it spread up my arm and started around here and then it went down my back. And then it started up this way on my face and then it started up on my face. I told him, I said, "You're sending me in,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're doing something."
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was the first thing they did. I can't remember how you say it. It's got that little green ball of soap. Is it Physahect or
Physaderm, maybe?
Excuse me, might be in there.
Okay.
When he got that, and that thing still hanging, that scrub brush, I thought, good.
Mm-hmm.
He scrubbed all that stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then put something on it and then
okay.
wrapped it. And, but he gave me some kind of medicine. He waited about 3 days.
Yeah.
He was clearing up, you know. But that was miserable. The flies would try to eat you up. But it would break open and it would just be oozing
mm-hmm.
sores
mm-hmm.
and then it would crust over again and it would break open.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything that could be done for that out in the field? Or I guess at that point you had to...
That doctor, he was a Navy doctor,
uh-huh.
he said, "What did your corpsman tell you to do?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, he said, don't wear my shirt and bathe as often as I could." And I can't tell you what he called me. You know? But he asked me how long I'd had it,
uh-huh.
you know. I don't know how long I'd had it out in the field, but like I say, I didn't get real concerned until it started up on my face. You know, I thought, we got to stop this. You know, I look like I have leprosy or something. But that doctor got really mad
mm-hmm.
at me. You know. And to punish him, this is something that never makes sense to me. To punish him, they took him out of the field. And I thought, well, that'll show. But, and I know, well, I had amoebic dysentery one time, and I was sick of a dog. And they finally sent me in, and they sent me to deny him. And I went in sort of like as an outpatient,
mm-hmm.
you know. Well, they gave me some kind of medicine. They told me to go back to my unit. So I went back to lift the motors, you know. Well, I'd taken one of those pills, and you know, when you burp,
mm-hmm.
it's like you're burping gasoline,
mm-hmm.
you know. Well, the first thing I had to do, I got hungry. Said I hadn't been hungry,
mm-hmm.
but I couldn't keep water down here either. And I went around because I got hired a guy, you know. And I thought, somebody somewhere slipped me some dope or something. Well, it never dawned on me it could be that medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So I went around and told that corner. I said, somebody slipped me something. I don't know. He said, well, I didn't take any medicine. I said, yeah, I took medicine. He said, that'll do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it cleared the mist.
Mm-hmm.
And it really did. It tasted like gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. And they were gelatin-looking capsules that I started.
Mm-hmm.
It cleared the mist. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about any problems with wildlife? Anything? Snakes? Or...
We never had any problems with snakes. We had trouble with water buffaloes.
Okay.
You know, because I think what it was mostly was the way that we smelled. Mm-hmm. Is we didn't smell like the vet man. Well, you know, every now and then one of them takes the notion that he's going to run over you, you know. Well, and they're sort of stocky, you know, and heavy. We didn't have any choice but shifting, you know, because it's like a bull, yeah. You know. And we had that happen.
Would they just charge people and they're just going to run them right over?
Yeah, just run right over. You know, here they'd come. You know. Of course, the thing about Vietnam and being 19, when they give you all the ammunition you want and these great big firecrackers, you know, you're like a kid on the 4th of July. You just... Well, like, when we would go through days or something where there wasn't anything happening,
mm-hmm.
the boredom, you would just get so bored. Well, like if you went on patrol, you would just frag caves and, or if you were close to a river, just throw your frags out in the water. Just see them blow up. Everybody knows. And, yeah, it's like having big toys, you know. But as far as I can't even remember.
Did you have any mascots or pets?
Had a puppy. In one bill, because we ran a search and destroy, and of course. I mean, search and destroy is exactly what, you know, you're supposed to take out whenever is there. Well, I don't know what happened to the mama dog, or if there's any more puppies, mm-hmm. but it was just this little puppy there, a black puppy. And I remember we called him Bear. And we would take turns in the squad. Like when we were moving, if we took him on patrol or out on an ambush, well, each guy would take turns. You'd take your helmet off and turn it upside down and put a towel in it,
mm-hmm.
and pour your water out of your canteen over it, and then set him down there. And then you'd carry it like this, you know. And it was, but you were talking about snakes and stuff. I don't know what happened to him. But when we were on an ambush one night, and he started whimpering, and he normally didn't do that. Well, we got a, you know, a poncho, throw it over for you, and turn our flashlight on, and something had bit him.
Mm-hmm.
And the corpsman worked with him, gave him some stuff, but didn't think mm-hmm. he died.
Yeah.
You know? And then, I don't remember having the opportunity to get another. Pet or anything, you know. Maybe that soured everybody on it, you know. Because it was all pretty crazy about him. Because you know?
Mm-hmm.
He would just couldn't carry your helmet, you know. And he would sit there and look around, you know. Just satisfied that he'd be. Solid black. But I don't have any idea what being, you know. And it might have been slim, you know.
Yeah.
But he lived like for some like 2 or 3 hours one day.
What about were there any instances of racial tension?
Yes. In your group, or there? Yeah. First of all, I want you to understand that I'm not a racist. You know, Lopez was my best friend. He was Puerto Rican, but we had a lot of trouble with the black guys. You know, because they didn't want to be in the field because of the danger. But then if they were in the rear, they'd put them on working parties all day, like filling sandbags or stringing barbed wire. And then they'd make them stand in the perimeter watching that. And they were hard to deal with, you know, because it didn't matter, you know, like what I told you, that Walter Point was voluntary, unless you didn't have somebody that would volunteer. Then you have to say, well, these three guys have walked it, there's the fourth one, it's your turn to walk point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you want me to walk point because I'm black. No, I don't want you to walk point because it's your turn, you know. And that caused problems, you know. And then the ones in the rear, you know, they were in the rear because they had back problems or stuff that you can't. I mean, just because it doesn't show up on an x-ray doesn't mean it's not there. Doesn't mean that it is there either. You know? And I had a lot of problems with that, you know, because they were always talking about, you know, this is a white man's war. Well, most of the guys in my squad were black, you know. So the basis for what they were saying didn't really help. And we had more trouble in the States with them than we did overseas. It got terrible out there, you know, the most problem for me. Yeah. Because they were always ganging up, you know, stuff. And I know that sounds bad, you know, but that's the way it was, you know. And the trouble that they had, they brought upon themselves, you know. And I was fortunate enough that, like my rank, like my company, gunnery sergeant, you know, I looked to him more than I did my platoon commander. Because your platoon commander's second lieutenant, you know, and there's a good chance he don't even know what's going on. They said the most dangerous thing in Vietnam was the second lieutenant with a map, and I believe it. But my company gunnery sergeant was a, man, he was, you know, he was your textbook, right? But if you had trouble with somebody and you went to him, you didn't have trouble no more. You know, because he went and counseled with the guy and got stuck. I think him, the only thing that I brought him to love him that really means something about him is Gunny Shad had me a plaque made. You know, it's a plain Jane plaque, and it said, "With appreciation, Sergeant Morris." Well, that might be the only thing that I had planned. I don't know where any of my bills are or anything, but I got that plaque. You know, and it's because I had so much respect for him, you know, and he gave it to me. That's why I'm still about it. Because Like I said, he was a Grange Marine. And if you did what you're supposed to, you took care of your business, he was behind you 100%. Mm-hmm. Don't try to miss him. Well, I'll tell you what happened one time.
These guys, and I don't know how I got picked for it. I just lucked out, I guess. I was in the field, and they called me out of the field to the rear. I had to, you know, catch the helicopter back in. Well, when I got there, I had to report to the company office. And when I got in there, Gunny Shad told me that I don't even know whose it was. Some of these guys, they needed their service record books.
And I said, okay. And I said, of course, my clothes. You know what my clothes look like.
I asked him if I could go down to the battalion supply and give me some of the utilities. He said, you go down to the battalion supply and get anything that you want. You know? I said, okay. So I went down there and I told the sergeant working in there that I needed the new issue of utilities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had the camouflage ones. Mm-hmm. And he said, of course, the second set he had issued to you when you came in country. And I said, I didn't have no second set issued to me. I mean, what you see is all I got. You know? He said, no, you ain't getting nothing. You know? Because you have a second set issued to you when you came in country. Well, I went back to the company office and I went in there and told Gunny Shad. I said, the sergeant down there won't give me anything. You know? He said, is that right? I said, that's right. Well, they just reached up, got him covered, and put it on. Well, we went down to the battalion supply, and Gunny Shad walked in there with me right beside him. And he said, who's the blank, blank, blank that's in charge here? And the sergeant said, I'm the blank, blank, blank. There was a counter, you know, everything. And Gunny Shad just reached over and got him by the collar and yanked him over the counter. And he told him, he said, I want you to give this man anything he wants. Do you understand? And so, yes, Gunny, I'll give him anything he wants. Gunny Shad, like, he looked at me and he said, if it gives you any more trouble, come back and get me. Okay, Gunny. And that guy, I mean, I got shot of socks, T-shirt, utilities. Well, I probably didn't get any boots. Mm-hmm. But I explained, I got a towel, you know, and towels were really hard to cut back. But, my unit went out.
This is disc two, continuing the interview with Butch Morris. You mentioned that around 1970, October, you were moved to the 1st Battalion, 1st Marines?
I believe it was 1st Battalion.
Okay.
Anyway, they made me assistant manager in an enlisted men's club at the 1st Marines Fireport base.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even remember what the name of Fireport base was.
Mm-hmm.
We were just south of the name of, like, you know, Freedom Hill was just a rock's throw away, and we was only like 5 miles south or something. Mm-hmm. And we were set up right on the South Tide Sea. It's where the fire support base was. And I was there until I got my flight date on November 25th.
What did you do as the manager?
As the assistant manager?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd keep, you know, the inventory up, and then I'd balance the books on, because we sold beer and sodas, I was sold, and both of them were a dime each. And then we had three Vietnamese women and one Vietnamese man at workforce, and I sort of watched after them. They kept the club clean during the day and kept the trash carried out and stuff like that. And then I'd go to Da Nang and go to the division warehouse and get pallets of beef mm-hmm. and cokes, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. And that's about all I did there. Mm-hmm. It was, and at night, or even during the bad staff, you know, out in the club area mm-hmm. to make sure there wasn't any trouble out there mm-hmm. or anything like that. Something I thought was really stupid is nobody can come in there with just a t-shirt and your utility trousers on hand and a regular camouflage shirt. And they couldn't wear their cap in the club, and they couldn't put their feet in the chairs. You know, and I thought, we're in a war zone, who cares? You know? And then if we had a USO show, I'd go into the lane, get a truck, go in the lane, pick the USO show up. Mm-hmm. And that was about it there. I know we got mortared one time there. It was in the afternoon. I think they were trying to go after the Combat Operations Center. Mm-hmm. And the only thing they blew up was a chapel. You know, because they would probably shoot that mortar, what's it called, Geronimo style. Mm-hmm. Instead of aiming it, you hold it between your legs with a towel wrapped around it, you know. And then what they would do, they'd walk the, you know, they'd see where that one hit, mm-hmm. you know. So they'd lower the muzzle a little bit to get the range from it. But, you know, that was, if I had like 4 years to do in the Corps, and no, I wouldn't get the nerdy out when I got home, mm-hmm. I'd re-up for another year if I could stay at that EM club. It was good duty.
Who made the decision? You went from infantry to working at
the EM club.
The club. How did that come about? Do you know?
I don't know. They just said, you mm-hmm. know, this is where you're going. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget, because I'm... In a lot of ways, I've never taken myself pretty seriously. Well, I had made sergeant, mm-hmm. you know. And I had to go to this club to be interviewed. Well, I walked in, there was a staff sergeant there that was the manager mm-hmm. of the club. And I didn't know he was like he was. But I walked in, he looked, and I said, I'm, you know, Sergeant Morris, I'm here to interview for the assistant manager guy. And they said, well, are you a sergeant? And I went, yeah. And he didn't have a sense of humor. And kind of find out he'd been on the drill field. Mm-hmm. You know. And he was ornery. No, he was mean. He had been in the field, and they finally moved him to the M Club because mm-hmm. Marines had fragged him 3 times with people trying to kill him. And he slept on one end of the club in a little room, and then all the way on the other end of the club, I slept mm-hmm. in a little room, you know. And of course, the Vietnamese that worked there, they had like the base,
okay.
you know, they couldn't stay overnight mm-hmm. there. And he called me Jim, and he told me, he said, that's where you got to know each other.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, he said, Jim, he said, I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to build a new room on this club, you know, and you can bunk in here with me. And I said, no. Not going to do it, because some other Marine tried to kill you, so I can kill me instead. I ain't doing it. And he taught me into doing it. And before we left there, I was fairly good friends mm-hmm. with him, you know. But we built our own shower on it. You know, we took a 55-gallon drum, mm-hmm. filled it up with water, and you'd let it sit in the sun all day when the water get hot, mm-hmm. you know. But I stayed, well, until I came home, mm-hmm. from around the 1st of October to the 25th of November. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you one thing they did to us, and I didn't know what they were doing when they first started because it hadn't happened. But we had that military painting certificate. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it looked like Monopoly money. Mm-hmm. You know. Well, one day they locked the gates. Nobody could go out and nobody could come in. Well, they did it first thing in the morning. Well, the civilian personnel, the Vietnamese, mm-hmm. couldn't come on the base.
Uh-huh.
You know. Well, they took up all of our money. You know, their Sergeant Morris, he turned in $25. And then the next day, they reissued it to you in the new military payment certificate. Mm-hmm. You know, like a $5 bill, say, was blue, well, now it's pink.
Huh.
And they did that because so much money would get into the Vietnamese hands, you know. Well, when they changed the color on it, changed it, a lot of money they had was no good then. They couldn't spend it for anything. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it was the day after that, I had to go to the mine to get something. But they had the engineers out. They had set up 155 round booby trap out close to the front gate. I guess it made them mad. And that NPC would just throw it everywhere because it was totally worthless. I mean, you know, when they went to bed that night, they might have had $20,000. Mm-hmm. And when they got up the next morning, they didn't have a dime, you know. And they did it because of the black market,
mm-hmm.
you know, to...
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, between getting mortared that time and that one deal, that's the only thing that ever happened up there.
And you mentioned USO shows.
Mm-hmm.
You picked up the entertainers and brought them back. Do you recall any of specific names? Or
No names. Okay. Because, well, they were like, I know one of them that I went after, they were all Koreans.
Okay.
You know.
But musical groups? Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's funny, a lot of the songs they sang were country and western songs. Yeah. And, of course, that didn't set some folks, you know, it was just right, right? And this isn't very nice, but, of course, I was, you know, 19 and silly and ignorant. But we went and picked up this USO show. And see, downtown Denain to the Marines was off limits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could go through it. If you were going from point A to point B,
uh-huh.
but you couldn't stop.
What
you
was know? That, do you know?
Just a rule.
Okay.
Marines are, you know. Well, when I was even in permanent personnel in California, you couldn't wear blue jeans. You know, not allowed.
Okay.
I don't know, that's what the course said. But it had like two or three girls or whatever. And I told that truck driver, I said, well, and we picked them up because they were really cute. You know? And I told him, I said, I'm going to ride the back of the truck. Well, I went around there and got in the back of the truck and sat down by this Korean girl. I had to look over, and she had more hair on her legs than I had on mine. So I beat on the cab of the truck and stopped the truck. And he said, why? I said, I'm getting back up in front of the truck. But they were, you know, they were fun.
Mm-hmm. How often would they, the USO, put on these types of shows?
I think I would have got two of them.
Okay.
You know, one of them, they both might have been Korean.
Mm-hmm.
But it was in downtown tonight, you know, which was a real trip for me because,
mm-hmm.
you know, so we couldn't go through there.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, down there, I don't know, you know, I carried 45 when I would go. But when I was with the second one, or the first Marines, I felt as safe there as I did right here, you know, because it just...
Mm-hmm.
You know, the area was too secure,
mm-hmm.
because the 5th Marines were still there, you know, and the 1st Marines were still there.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're still out there running patrols, mm-hmm. and all this stuff, you know. So it's, you know, like I say, I didn't feel, as far as a threat to me or anything, I didn't feel any of that.
Mm-hmm. You know, did you ever get the opportunity for any R&R?
Yes, ma'am. Went to Bangkok, Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was there 5 days. In course, that was another one of those deals, you know. It was funny when you got off the plane. I picked up on my cram, took you to the R&R Center.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that they told you, you know, you can do just about anything you want to, but don't raise much money, you know,
mm-hmm.
that'll get you in trouble. But when, as we first walked in the door there, they handed us a glass of beer and a wet washcloth, a good washcloth. And they told us, you know, first off, don't find some girl and fall in love and get married.
They actually told you that?
Yeah. You know. But it was, I mean, it was just party time.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, I guess it's, of course, I hadn't had a drink. Well, I don't know. It's sad, right? It doesn't taste near as good as it did before I turned 21.
Yeah.
You know? But I rented this taxi driver for all the way for $20. The motel was $5, or the hotel was $5 a night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a nice place.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to this club one night, and I would call it the disco club now, I can't remember. But I had 7 or 8 mixed drinks, and they'd watered them down, you know, I mean, all the American there. Well, this taxi driver raised his coat and he had a bottle of Thai whiskey. It was 180 proof. And he said, you want some of this? And I said, sure. And I had a glass of ice at it, you know, I started pouring them. Well, there was a young lady sitting with the gym. And I started pouring that in a glass. She grabbed my arm. She said, no, 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 no. I'll make you boo-coo, dinky down. And I said, I can't. No, I couldn't. Last thing I remember seeing is that big old silver ball going around in the And I woke up the next morning in the hotel, you know, wondering how I got there. But that taxi driver, he took me down to the South China Sea, rode horses, you know.
You rode horses?
Mm-hmm. Went swimming, went bowling. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a really nice bowling alley. Mm-hmm. And went to indoor movie theater mm-hmm. in Bangkok someplace. And have you ever seen that show, A Man Called Horse, with Richard Harris?
I don't think so.
That's what was shown.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And that's an American movie?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what was funny, you know, like in our movie theater, sell popcorn and mm-hmm. coats and candy, stuff like that. They sold fruit there,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it was delicious. And then I went to one place, and I think they call it Timland. But what it was sort of like all of Thailand, you know, put in this little amusement park. And they had sword fighting demonstrations, stuff like that. And they were really good at it because, they were just play acting,
mm-hmm.
you know. And they had rooster fights and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
and elephants. But that. It was funny, before I left, going back to Nam, I bought 2 switchblade knives.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was going through customs, they took them. And I asked a guy, I said, why are you taking those? He said, gosh, they're classified as deadly weapons. And I thought, you know, I carry an M16 and a law, 3 or 4 pounds of C4, 5 frags. 1,000 rounds of ammunition.
Yeah.
And you're concerned about 2 switchblade knives. But one thing that I remember, Kim, it seemed like the plane that we took from Da Nang to Bangkok was something like Northwest or
something.
Those stewardesses on that plane, I believe we're the three ugliest women I've ever seen in my life. And I thought, I know why y'all done this, because we haven't seen a woman that looked like a woman, you know, because I'd known her like 8 months before I went on R&R, you know. And I guess it's afraid to put, you know, young, nice looking women on the flight.
They had it all planned out.
They did, they knew what they were doing, yeah. But I, you know, in a lot of ways, I regret going. And then a lot of ways I don't, because I don't know if I'll ever have as good a friend as I had in Lopez, you know. And of course, the way it was handled, you know, when we finally wound up, even though it wound up the way it did, I can't let myself believe that the guys' names there on that wall died in vain. I can't believe that. I won't believe it. You know? Because there was some really good guys.
So, you came back to the States November
1970? No, well, I actually got back to the States on December 1st.
Oh, okay.
I got out December 3rd. Okay. And I was home December 3rd.
Okay. And where did you fly back into? Into California?
Again? Yeah, well, before we first... So we went from Da Nang to Okinawa and stayed 5 days. Okay. And we left Okinawa. Okinawa, we went to Japan and refueled. Mm-hmm. We flew from Japan to Tacoma, Washington. And I'll always think that Tacoma, Washington is the prettiest place in the world. Because it was all these lights and you could see all these cars moving out. And then we flew down to San Bernardino, California, and they put us on buses. Mm-hmm. You know. First they took us to San Diego and found out that wasn't where we were supposed to be, and they turned around and took us back to Camp Pendleton.
Did you come across, run into any anti-war demonstrations at the airport or anything like that?
No, I'll tell you the only thing that, well, Christmas, you know, just after I got there, a lot of people donated. I think what they did is they would donate money and then the Red Cross or something would take that money and then buy little packages, you know, like it had like toothpaste and gum and stuff like that. And then they would say, this is so and so that lives in Pennsylvania, you know, this is their address. We write a thank you note. But one guy got a package and he unwrapped it. And it was a can of dog food. And it said, oh, I guess this is paraphrasing it, something to the effect, here, this is what you deserve because of the animal that you are. And then when I got home, a lot of people that I thought were my friends when I got home, where you been? I ain't seen you in a long time. Well, I've been to Vietnam. Well, that was stupid. You know? I don't guess she's my friend after all. You know? And it was... I guess that happened to me 3 or 4 times. But you sort of... I guess you sort of toughen yourself to it and block it out.
How do you feel about your service in Vietnam?
For the majority of it, I feel like I did the honorable thing. You know, there was some things happened that I would change if I could go back. You know, but I still feel like that we were there for a good cause. You know, if the politicians who left us alone
we would have kicked them out of Vietnam.
Because we had everything we needed. Mm-hmm.
But they, you know, when, like when Johnson says, you know, you can bomb this target, this target, and this target, and let's say that this Navy pilot bombs something else, and they court-martial him, and the next day that's on the approved bombing list. It doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. And they would even come down and say, this is the route that you're to take to go in on your bombing run. Well, when you do that so much, they know where to set the missiles up and the anti-aircraft batteries and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's because the politicians were scared to death that they were going to get Red China involved in it. That China didn't want that place.
How close did you follow politics or policy making while you were there soon after you came back?
No.
Were you aware of the bigger picture, so to speak? What?
Mm-hmm.
No.
No, because it what you had to do, people worked in platoon size groups most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you pretty well focused on what you were doing. And one of the things that you had to learn, and this was a terribly hard lesson, but you had no choice but to learn it. You could be sitting around talking,
mm-hmm.
and a sniper killed one of the guys in the platoon, you know, maybe 20 feet from you. And then they'd call you up and tell you to take out patrol. Well, that guy that just got killed, you can't think about him anymore because, you know, I can't think about him because I got these eight with me that I got to think about. And if I'm thinking about him, I'm liable to get one of them killed.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that's pretty much as far as we can say.
What about lessons learned from Vietnam? Do you think the military today has taken anything from Vietnam? As far as how things are done today, or
probably the military, you know, would fight the war pretty much the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the politicians may have learned to stay out of it, you know, because you can't run a war from 10,000 miles away. You got to be there. It's just like, you know, when Desert Storm, Schwarzkopf. They tell him, there it is, you
mm-hmm.
take it.
Mm-hmm.
You do what has to be done. Well, he was there. He knew what to do, and he knew what he had to do, and he did it. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that Washington told him was stop. You know, this is as far as you're going, which was a mistake. But the show went on and got, you know, Saddam Hussein out there. But that was the politicians. The military knows how to run a war. You know, and I don't think they would change much of it, except, you know, the B-52 bomber is an extremely good weapon if it's used right. And if they had to turn them loose, if they had done anything, but you know, the harbor at Haiphong and Hanoi, and the rail system, the road system, the electrical system, the power system, you know, and I'd bomb that Mekong Delta till they had water running out of their ear. When you break the civilian's will, or the civilian population's will, the war's over. And we're a good example of that. Because that's what they did. I read one time when they were over there bringing some of the POWs home that an American
general, I assume he was probably Air Force, told one of the North Vietnamese generals, you never defeat us on the battlefield. And he told him that's irrelevant. And it was. Mm-hmm. They won anyway. But it's, yeah. And I don't know if I, like Trey, if it was something that was vital to the interests of this country, and I knew that they were going to let the military do what was necessary, I probably wouldn't stand in his way too much, you know, because to me, if you don't have your honor, you don't have anything. And I couldn't stand up and tell him what to do. Mm-hmm. As bad as I hate seeing go. But if it was a deal like Johnson Run, I'd tell him, I'd take him, you know. You may not ever get to be a doctor, but you're leaving, you know. You're not doing this. Mm-hmm. And you know, hopefully that won't ever happen.
Is there anything else you'd like to add about your time in Vietnam or anything else you want?
Oh, no, I guess, Kim, the only thing that I'd like to say is I appreciate what y'all are doing. You know, because for a long, long time, nobody wanted to listen to us because it was like, why don't you just go away? You know, I don't want to hear about it. Well, it's good to know that somebody cares. And, you know, somebody that will get our side in it, you know. You know, and I'm not different than probably all the other guys that were in combat units over there. You know? But it's sort of an indication that finally somebody wants to know what happened, you know. And I appreciate y'all being there.
This concludes the interview with Butch Morris. Thank you very much.